Welcome to the API Resilience Podcast. If you've ever wondered what it really is we do when we do APIs, and if you've wondered how APIs change organizations, our communities, and our society, look no further. This is the podcast you've been searching for. I'm Christoph von Tomme, and together with my co-host Mark Bergauer and our guests, we explore how deliberate complexity, social practice theory, and a deeper understanding of socio-technical systems can transform our organizations and the world we live in. Welcome to the API Resilience Podcast. Today, we've got Chris McDermott as our guest. Chris is a transformation coach and co-founder of Contextualize, a consultancy formed to do organizational research to inform transformation and change initiatives. He has been involved in lean and agile ways of working for around 20 years and was the founder and former organizer of the Lean Agile Scotland Conference and Lean Agile Glasgow Meetup. Chris has an interest in systems, complexity, and social practice theory. And Chris is also a good friend of Mark. So
We work together. So we have a company together. But yes, we were friends first.
Yes, it's going to be a very interesting conversation. And it feels like we're among friends. So it's going to be very interesting to see where this is going. Now we're talking about this more complexity topic. So welcome, Chris.
Thank you very much. Been looking forward to this. Forward very much.
So Chris, as a first question, this is one that we've asked a lot of people already on the podcast. One thing that's really interesting, interesting is a very vague word for that, but peculiar is that people don't really like talking about complexity. What we've noticed is that most of the people we've had on as guests have developed some indirect way to talk about complexity so that they don't have to mention the C word with their customers. Is that an experience that you're sharing? And if so, what do you do when you need to bring up the C word?
I tend to focus the conversation on uncertainty. So how certain can we be about the actions we take and the things we do and the work we do, that the outcomes that we predict we will get, we will get. And then when we sort of establish a basis of uncertainty, we then can start talking about what approach do we want to take in order to manage this uncertainty, work in this uncertain environment. And that leads to a lot of conversation about experimentation. So as soon as, I think for me, certainly working with leaders, when leaders get to that recognition that there is an uncertain environment, you can then start shifting them away from this very deterministic, you know, we're going to run this project, it's going to give us all this value, it's going to be amazing, into a more of a let's experiment, let's probe, let's kind of try multiple things to solve this problem to see what is the best solution to a problem and then evolve from there. So certainly for me, talking about uncertainty. A client I worked with for quite a while, stopped working with early in the year, they had been through, some of the colleagues in the organisation had the Kinevan chat from some people, and boiled down to two things for some of the key people I spent most of my time with, was, are we dealing with a cat or are we dealing with a clock? So when they had that kind of imagery in their mind, we could then, again, right, appropriately discuss how we will move forward. But they'd kind of been sort of had an introduction to complexity, but they didn't really, it wasn't a language that had stuck with them. They just kind of had those broad themes of, this is something that's, I wouldn't say it wasn't a language that stuck with them, it wasn't something they comfortably conversed about in the teams and in the various areas they worked together. But having the cat and clock was a good way for them to say, okay, this is how we need to approach this vice. And if it's cat, it's an uncertain space, we don't know how it's going to react. If it's a clock, it's a machine, it's predictable, let's go this other way, use the other path, use other practices.
It feels a bit like, even with uncertainty, it's the same, it's often the same, it's this feeling of lack of power because of which people want to disengage from it, or they want to shy away from it, or look away. Do you have the same experience with uncertainty? A lot of our experience of uncertainty is today wrapped into language of probability. And actually, that's not what complexity normally is about. It's actually, do you have a way to make that differentiation between more external catastrophe things and things that are more like cats?
Yeah, that's a good question. The thing that really kind of hit home for the, certainly the clients I was working with at the time, that the ideas that things are uncertain and you have to act in a different way was lockdown and COVID, that external catastrophe, that, that huge thing that happened. But it did kind of, I think it, maybe those circumstances and other circumstances create a level of, maybe a growing level of honesty about a situation. So uncertainty becomes an easier thing to talk about if there's a level of honesty that's in the context and the environment where people are discussing it.
I think that the moment you push a large catastrophe through a complex system, you again get complex behavior.
Yep. I think it's about reaction. So it's about how you act in a situation. That's what I always think about, where I think having a kind of familiarity with complexity is really incredibly helpful. It's about determining how you're going to take your next steps. So thinking away from all of these next steps to what is the next right step. Those are the maybe the small ways. We say, here is, so we'll probably go on to this, I'm sure we will. We'll go on to the practice theory and that kind of stuff at a later point. But when I kind of start to talk about practices and environment, we try to make improvement, there might be lots and lots and lots of things that you can do, but it's always that, you can do all of these things. You don't have capacity as a first kind of thing. You can, obvious thing you can knock out of the way and stop people kind of drying, going, taking you down a path of fantasy football. I think that's how Mark tends to put it. But you kind of look at what's the next right thing. So those small steps, those small things, how do we know that what we do is going to change the situation, put in a safer space, give us more value, whatever it may be. It's the next, just going and focusing on the next things that's, I find, useful in the smaller, I suppose.
How did you get in touch with complexity? What was your complexity baptism?
My journey to complexity, I think it started through systems thinking and beginning to understand the world as connected and interrelated. And that kind of, that happened when I think I was early in 2012, something like that. I was interested in Kanban. And Kanban, the way in which it had been adapted through and is evident now in the software world, going to get interested then. And then people drew me towards Lean. I have a think about Lean, and I learned a lot about Lean. I think I was actually working in an organization who, in their manufacturing side, talked a lot about Lean. So there was a bit of an overlap there. But in that space, I then became interested in Deming, with the way of Deming, Russell Acuff, John Seddon, who's a systems thinker from the UK, does a lot of work in the public sector. And I think I remember one person in particular saying to me, if you think that's interesting, you should get your head into the complexity space. Mm-hmm. And Lean Agile Scotland played a big part in that, because Dave Snowden, we invited Dave Snowden to Lean Agile Scotland in 2013. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fair to say he melted a lot of brains that day when he gave his keynote back then. A lot of us were saying, well, certainly for me, it was a bit of a baptism of complexity and understanding complex systems. And it was just one of those things, a little teaser that sort of drew me in to do me further down that path. But it was what I found really interesting is Acuff is probably round about the time, maybe slightly about the same time as Prigogine. Who wrote the kind of, I guess, the one of the fathers of complexity, founders, fathers, and
discoverers.
Discoverers, yeah, that's a better word. And Acuff, while he didn't speak about complexity, and he spoke very much in the same way of systems thinkers of his time, I think there's certain things about the way he spoke that made me think he kind of got the uncertain nature of systems. Whereas, I think there's a lot of argument about likes of Senge and his description of systems thinking and the behaviours that emerged around the time with the Senge was very much business process re-engineering and understanding holes and acting on holes, doing the what is the current state, what is the future state, close the gap, that kind of activity. But yeah, I found that was my path through those folks.
How did you meet Mark? So,
I think like most people meet Mark, I met Mark on Twitter. That was my first introduction to Mark. just that was around about 2011, just as we were starting to organise Lean Agile Scotland the first time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Mark helped a lot with Lean Agile Scotland to the point where I said right now officially help with Lean Agile Scotland because it was about 2015 or something. After 2014, it just got a bit too big for one person to be running around and trying to organise.
It's interesting how communities really shape us, and especially if you're a community organizer, how big the effect it has on, yeah, on your whole life. I think it sounds that for both of you, that was a very similar experience.
The Lean Agile Scotland was huge for me, utterly huge. I went from someone who was, I remember working in an organization, my first XP team, I went about 2008, and they said, come along to meetup, come on. And I was so nervous at the thought of going to meetup to maybe, what, 3 years later, standing in front of my first Lean Agile Scotland audience saying, hey, people, welcome to this conference I've organised, complete flip. But it was huge for me. It was huge with the sort of network of people got to meet, the things got to learn. I often sort of, but one of the reasons very early on with Lean Agile Scotland, I decided I was going to record everything, every talk I was going to record, was with both for a community aspect and sharing it widely in the community, but also my very selfish aspect, knowing that I will not get to all the talks every year and having a few weeks worth of watching material after it, which I love. I often go back to the Agile Scotland talks, partly to reminisce, but also to sort of remind myself of some of the great things that was said.
I have this, it's not a theory, it's more, I don't know, maybe it is a theory that communities act like quantum computers, and that there's like so many concurrent connections at the same time that they can solve really hard problems much faster than any single person can solve them individually. So it's kind of like the single thread computing versus quantum computing kind of thing. I think this connects a little bit to the community of practice versus community of solution discussion that I've had with Mark. But there's always somebody who can connect you to someone who knows someone.
Yeah.
And then ideas just move much faster once you've got a couple of good minds together.
We found, there was a core group of people who kept returning to Lean Agile Scotland. And we kept inviting back. We felt they were really just super interesting people to speak to all the time and hear from and learn from. But they were also people who would go out every year and experiment and try new things and want to come back and share them. Mm-hmm. So they were always spreading, you know, the wings, getting new ideas. They were very much, I think, the community of needs. They were there trying to solve problems together. When the organising started to become a little bit easier, I think we had a bit more of a routine to it. I could spend more time with people. Never really got to that time I really wanted to spend, but you could have some of that hallway chat time with speakers, and it was great to hear their stories. And yeah, and not only the speakers, but the returning attendees who would come back year in, year out, and sort of want to have those conversations. And it was a strong community.
Yeah, that's kind of like the your roads into complexity. And also like how you're using or how you're talking about complexity.
Yep.
What kind of role does complexity play in your day-to-day, let's say working life for a start? We're here to talk about social practices, obviously. but is that now 100% of your complexity connected work, or there's other pieces of work that you still, I think right now your main job is social practice consulting. Is that correct?
It's still transformation coaching, but as the practice that we've developed around maturity mapping evolves and matures, becomes much more prominent in my coaching. It is something that I can, whether it's my bias or not, I can take to nearly every context in which there's come and talk to me, and I feel the need to either think about it through a practice lens or draw it. Let's see it on a map, an improvement or a maturity map, which I think is, that's where my complexity thinking is. I have to admit though, complexity for me is one of these things that sits underneath what's done for me, and it isn't maybe like other people you alluded to earlier on, you've spoken to. It's not something I feel the need to bring out in the open to talk about all the time.
That is a common thread.
It's a shared experience, yes.
So almost all our attendees of this podcast have shared the experience that you're not explicitly talking about complexity, that they have means, methods, theories, etc., that they employ to get around it. So the other common thread is that you can only talk with people about complexity if they actually have a real tangible experience. So first of all, that they share with you or that you're in it with them. Mm-hmm. And so COVID has been a big enabler, I think, in many organizations exactly for that, because people were experiencing it and had to cope with it. And so you could call it that. But a common thread is, no, usually you can't talk about it. Mm-hmm. So yes, maturity mapping social practice is theory, is what Chris and I believe is an enabler. How can you deal with the questions and the problems that the teams experience in, especially dealing with change, in a way that you not constantly have to put complexity, it's complex, in front of them and the sort of, oh, what shall we do? attitude.
Yes.
Yeah, there's certainly something there, but I don't feel the need to talk about complexity in a work environment, and I need to avoid talking about complexity. It's I think I found it is a deep theory. I still struggle to understand Alicia's description of constraints and how constraints act and how constraints close. But I think it's a really deep theory, and I think it's something that takes people away from the problems they're interested in solving when you try and talk to them about the theoretical underpinnings of the problems they're trying to solve. It's I think it's much better to be up talking about their practices. What is it you do? You know, what does good look like to you? How would you like to improve the situation? How do these practices connect and relate? Yeah, I think that's
why you hire people like us, is we come and help you navigate the complexity without just exposing you to it, you know. So, yeah, let's come and just take all your lovely rose-tinted filters away, but then leave you in the mess. No, that's, you want to hire people with understanding of complexity exactly for the reason that they give you, guidance and navigation means and blah, 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 so you can make sense of what you need to make sense without the whole having to understand complexity theory, which, yes, as Chris actually points out, is hard to understand and is in itself, you know, there's not a silver bullet yet or ever will be. Here's your method. Here's your recipe, how you solve your complexity problems. Yeah. I mean, the biggest insight of complexity is you have to start with context first. And so there will never be a silver bullet.
Yeah.
But there are ways how you can navigate.
It's the big anti-proof. That's like proving that there, basically complexity is almost like proving that there's no utopia. It's just whatever you do, it's going to be complex.
I'm not sure that's true, but so I think one of the insights of complexity is if you can imagine the utopia, then it's wrong. As in, the thing that will work is not the thing we can imagine, but the thing that we have to discover in bringing about. So actually following utopias is harmful because it desensitizes you to your context. You suddenly look at the horizon and you're not paying attention to the boulders that are in front of you that you're going to stumble upon.
So would it help answer the question here if we kind of maybe describe what we mean by practice?
Let's do that. Shall we?
Yeah, and we can maybe talk about how we see them and how we use. So there are a number of practice theories. I think there is any one sort of universal way or universal practice theory. But the practice, the theory we subscribe to is a theory that was a social practice theory, which was it's kind of articulated by predominantly by Elizabeth Shove. And I think her branch of theory comes from Ted Shatsky, who talks about practice being an activity time space, something you do at a point in time in a space. The way Elizabeth goes on to describe practice is in three interrelated or interacting elements. their meaning. And that's number one. It's like, why do we do what we do? What's the purpose? What's the motivation? What's the imagery we have of this thing that makes us do this thing? The other part to it is competence. What skills, you know, do we have? What knowledge do we have? What's our, how do we know how to do something? And what underlying, would we know that enables us to do it? And then materials. So what are the things we use in order to do it? So that's the kind of how these three elements interact, which create practice. My current favorite way of helping people experience and understand this is by asking everyone, when I'm doing talks or whatnot, to get a pen and paper and write their name on paper. And that's it. You've just carried out a social practice. Congratulations, you're a social practicer, practitioner, a social practitioner. You have done something with a material or materials, a paper and pen. You've used your competence, your knowledge of letters, your knowledge of the letters that combine to make your name, and how you hold a pen in order to recreate them. And you've done it for a reason, primarily because I've asked you to demonstrate social practice theory. But you can think of many other reasons why you do that.
The letters only carry meaning because they're social constructs. Yep. The practice is happening in a social context, not even beyond the purpose. Also, the activity, the activities themselves, and probably even the tooling are happening in a social context.
Yep. Yeah,
that's a good one.
That to me is that. So the other ways that I kind of help people are just with that simple example to think about different contexts. Mm-hmm. And what about the practice changes as the context changes around? I haven't done this, but I might ask them, you know, how might you do this in a different language? How might your, maybe asking to write their name is maybe, well, how has your name said or written, or what's the translation of your name into other languages? That could be one way to think about it. The other way could be, what if I asked you to sign your name? How would that change the practice? Mm-hmm. What if you typed your name? How would that change the practice? So it's taking those different contexts and then re-examining the practice. How does that practice, how do we do that practice? The next kind of thing, I think that practice in itself, I think, is a really interesting way of understanding, just take practice on its own, of understanding what happens in a complex environment. So if you take what I often see with organizations when they think about change, let's go back to that sort of space, they think about people, process, and technology. These mm-hmm. are the key drivers. But those things, these are big things. These are large things to consider, and it not necessarily considered in the interrelation of the three. Whereas practice takes us down to a level of doing what you actually do on a day-to-day basis, and how you as an agent, as a person in a space, carry out a practice with a tool and your skills. And what are the surrounding meanings and drivers in an environment that encourage you to do it in the way in which you do it? How does the system constrain you to do it in that way? So but what I think is also really interesting is that with this understanding of practice, you can then start to consider, what does this mean for other practices? How do multiple practices happen in an environment to achieve an outcome? My go-to in this is always driving. How does the practices of driving interrelate to take you from A to B? You know, and I'm calling it driving, and you could think of driving as a practice, but actually there are other practices that interrelate to give you the capability to drive. So you need to know how to steer and how to brake and how to, you know, accelerate and how to check your mirror and you change gear and all of these things. And then you can think about all of those things as independent practice. You can understand them with meaning, material, and competence. And then you can see how the material overlaps. How does the clutch overlap with the gear stick and the, you know, the braking and changing of gears? How do these things interrelate? So you can start to think about the growing kind of system and context in which you want to examine, and how the practice lens gives you three very kind of, tangible or, you know, very kind of grasp observable ways in which you can understand the things independently and the whole system at the end of the day.
So in, because this sounds all very social science-y. But you're working in software, or mostly in software teams. How did you end up applying the social science stuff to software teams? Why do you think it's so important that people look through a practice lens at software systems? What is the caveats of not doing it, and what are the kind of problems that you can help to remediate in organizations?
So if I go back to the start, you said, why did I start looking at this? Mm-hmm. So as a coach working with teams, I'm looking at how they as social entities, social groups, interact to deliver an outcome or a goal for an organization. So my focus is predominantly on their interactions anyway, and how they work together and what their practices were. I came to this because I'd gone from a position where I was working with two teams and I could see both of those teams, and I worked on a day-to-day basis with those teams, to then be asked to, okay, here are another 7 or 8 teams we want you to start to work with. And being, they were both in at the time in different cities, and thinking, how am I going to get around all of these teams? There were different contexts they were all working in. And realizing that to really be effective as a coach, you have to kind of get yourself into that context they're in and observe and understand them, and wanting a way of which to then work out how to tactically help them with the various different things and focus on the thing that helps them and not necessarily be around in the whole. And it struck me in a sort of, Mark and I have been discussing this now for a number of years, but Wordly maps were a really interesting way of visualizing
technology.
Teams, mm-hmm. to definitely technology, but Simon also talked about practice, mm-hmm. okay. and on maps. So one of the kind of four elements, I think he maps, mm-hmm. data, knowledge, technology, and he calls it activities, but I think it predominantly sort of materializes as things, as material things, as tools, etc. And I think his evolutionary axis is very much is established around the evolution of things. The practice evolves in a dependent way with things, but I think it's very much around the evolution of things. So the maps for me were an initial thought about how we could start to see how teams operate. It became more social science-y when a friend of ours, Jade Bloom, puts 3 sticky notes on a wall, and one said meaning, the other said material, the other said competence. And he said, go look at that. I think for us it's always been social. It wasn't about looking at tools and understanding the kind of specifically just the tools that people use. It's almost always social, certainly as a coach or an agile lean coach in an environment. It was about their interactions and how you made workflow, and what are the practices that teams use to ensure they have quality. I think what social practice theory has done, and Shove's, particularly Elizabeth Shove's articulation of practice theory, has given us an elegant way in which to describe them, a way in which we can observe the complexities of these environments and create a model which is context specific. It's a model that describes their teams and their environment. It might not be perfect, all models are wrong, some are useful, blah, 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 I've heard that before, but it's a way in which we can develop a shared understanding of a context in order to then act. I think in knowledge work, one of the reasons why I think Kanban became popular is because it took the work knowledge workers was doing and made it visible. And it made it visible at a very high level. Here are the steps we take. What I kind of think with practice theory and maturity mapping is that we can make visible the practices they do to deliver the work teams do, and not make visible in a kind of, we've mapped you, we're going to go and show you to your boss and he's going to come along and tell you you're doing it wrong, but a way in which people can look at it themselves and say, okay, this is our shared understanding of our current context. What do we want to do about it? What are the things that we can do to improve it?
I'm trying to build a connection for people that are listening from the API community and the API angle to make it obvious. For me, it's obvious already. I've seen in the API community, I've seen people starting to talk about socio-technical systems. So there's some of that awareness is happening. It's not always expressed. There's still a lot of tools and a lot of focus on just merely the material aspects of the social practices. Often, we in our work building developer portals, we often come in contact with organizations that are like, somebody in senior management has decided that we need to do APIs because that's how AWS got really successful. So we're doing APIs now, okay? And then, but what are you doing with your APIs exactly? And then how do you turn it into something that becomes more meaningful and that has a bigger impact? It keeps coming back to this hyper focus on the material, because that's a scalable thing. Like as a company, you're asked, so where's your product? Okay, so you're doing services. That's great, but you know, services don't scale. You know that, right? And how are you going to scale? And it's this. This is something that we've struggled with as a consultancy. You know, do you then go and generalize, even when maybe it's not the right time yet to generalize, or do you keep embracing the complexity of the individual customer and trying to give them the solution that they need, or set them on the path towards that solution? So I think that's in that world for me, social practices and maturity mapping lives, where you say, well, tools are just the start. Like, here's the other pieces that you need to make this work, and developing a language for that is something that people can understand. Also, Mark, you're awfully quiet.
I'm trying not to jump in. So just to defend a little bit, maybe senior people in an organization, and why do they act the way they do is often also what kind of options that are actually available to them. So first of all, they have a responsibility to act, but also they have a social pressure to act in a way that is seen as beneficial within the organization. And then, so that they have a propensity for action. And commonly in organizations, you know, what kind of information radiators can they access in order to actually see what options they have? So there's the material option. Yeah, so it's very easy to understand, okay, we're currently using this technology or this technology. Our competitor uses another technology, etc. So we're just going to use the other. These things happen because they're obvious.
Observable, yep.
And we have, yeah, they're documented, and, you know, they can go and look them up or easily ask a question, and there's easy answer. What are we using? Why are we not using that? Could we be using that? What a social science-y kind of approach enables you to do is actually start surfacing tangible options in terms of how you do the organizing. Yeah. So less about what is missing in terms of technology or what could be replaced or blah, 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 but how could we change the organization or aspects of the organization so that more valuable things become more likely. So if you look at how management consulting traditionally looks at this, either they give you recipes that you follow without really understanding where they're coming from, what the implications are, and we now see this more and more often, that consultancies like McKinsey, etc., know exactly when they tell you to do X, that in 3 years' time you're going to be in this quagmire that they will come back to you. So pulled them out of that one, but how to also keep you in this dependency relationship, etc. Social science gives organizations actually opportunity to look at themselves. So what we try to teach them is actually a different way of looking at themselves and analyzing how they're currently doing things so that they see what options they have to do things differently. So we shouldn't be too judgmental in my opinion, about, you know, what managers currently do, because it's also not often we hear this is totally company culture, but ultimately this is all, you know, so you could say Western European society. If you look at how governments work and how laws are made or unmade or etc., as we can see now in America, this kind of thinking permeates our Western culture. And starting looking through the social lens is novel. So social sciences came much, or became sciency much later, yeah, than natural sciences, etc. So we shouldn't be too judgmental. The reason we are judgmental is sometimes you have individuals which have, for whatever reason, a history that has sensitized them to already have some intuition for these things and hence act better. Yeah, so good leaders, enablers, etc. But they're still the exception. So it's, you know, the future already exists. It's just not evenly distributed kind of phenomenon. And what we can do with social science is actually start understanding, so what has actually enabled that future that already exists and how can we make it more distributed?
These change programs are pushed onto organizations with too much focus on the material aspects. There's a focus on what technology are we going to buy? And like we're doing an RFP, and then we buy a tool, and then, yeah, maybe you get an enablement company that's going to be training your people. But then it's still generic knowledge that is being trained. It's not evolving the practices that are going to make that organization successful with the technology.
Also, this scenario is one of the cases where we connected the dots. So I experienced this in a bank that wanted to adopt a middleware tool. And I was coaching in this bank, and at the time, part of my job then was to help figure out, so what needs to happen so that the tool is adopted. Mm-hmm. And then you go to what kind of problems is it trying to solve? You talk to the people who work in the problem spaces, and they say, oh, yeah, okay, you can do this, but actually, if we want that, much easier we'll be doing the other thing. And you start to realize, okay, so if you actually want to adopt a tool, whether you're successful or not depends on whether it actually fits existing practices. Can existing practices be evolved to benefit from the tool? And if you don't have the right practices, as was there the case, then tool adoption will be immensely painful, yeah? And whenever you have tool adoption in an organization that is painful, one of the things, so if you look at it and hear the stories from it, what you hear is, it doesn't fit current practice. Mm-hmm. And it's painful because the change is not organic, it's not the right thing, so to speak. So you say they have too much material focus, these decision makers, but the reason for that is we're living in a materially focused society. So all their life, their thinking was honed to be materially focused. So no wonder they now, so we all have a material focus by default.
I think what you see is previously the organizations and teams who worked well, they had a strong relationships and strong connections between each other. And the leaders in those environments were, you know, could speak to them, could connect with them, could relate to them. There could be connections. They could talk about work. Whereas now those relationships are not severed, but they're much, much harder because of the connections that people now have around work. It's no longer, there's no longer any kind of sort of chance conversations. All conversations now are more likely to be organized and scheduled and so on and so forth. So the way in which work is, you know, is seen to be more effective is through management of task and getting atomic things done. And also what I think from that is you because you can't see the work and how people work together, you're going to lose empathy for how work is done. And I think that's, to bring us full circle back to the practice theory, I think that's what I think, with knowledge work being invisible, I think the idea of visualizing practices and showing how practices relate to each other to get work done can help us see where those interactions are not good interactions, where they once were interactions that happened because of the context in which people the spatial context in which people worked and the behaviours and the practices that encouraged. Now this is a different spatial context. Yeah, the practice is now different. So how can we then see and think about how those different practices relate and how people can be effective in work? I see that, you know, my last few sort of major pieces of work have been in government, and the work the two agencies are doing are under high demand. They are, and the backlogs that they have are growing partly because the agencies are unable to deliver at this pace in which they were delivering before, because they don't have those connections and relationships in the work. Organisations will inevitably look to be more effective by looking at the things they can see. And even more so in these circumstances, I think they're less likely to see the people and the interactions of people and more the material things they use, because those are the, again, more observable things, more evident things.
Thank you. That's a really good correction. It's about the organizations that are making decisions rather than the people. That's a good point. That's also why I'm excited about maturity mapping, because it's a way of making the social visual, which makes it a lot easier to interact with. And then I don't think that it's, well, there's nobody who wakes up and says, I'm going to ignore this really important stuff here just because they're doing it, because they don't know how to touch it. There's no way to address it. And it's like organizational dark matter that just sits in your organization. You have no idea what it's doing. The stars that you can see are the tools that are floating in that space. And so making the dark matter visual and something that now we can talk about that changes all of that. I read this book about competitive advantages, and it told a story. I talked about it with Mark, and I think he said that it was already half debunked. But it was the story about how, well, actually I have to say the name because otherwise it doesn't make sense. So how Toyota had this huge advantage in their ability to produce cars, and then the American car industry was looking at it as like, yeah, how do we replicate them? And that then they actually created a joint venture together with Toyota, where they started developing those practices. And I won't go too much in detail about that, but they called that out, this coherence of how it all fits together, as an uncopyable competitive advantage for an organization, because you just can't really copy it. Like you can take the same books, or you can create a manual that explains how to do all these things, but still you can't copy it because you have to contextualize it.
No, I think this is when I was kind of initially sort of dipping into social practice theory, this was one of the things I found the most interesting. The concept of one thing, one practice going from one context to another context. It's not, you said contextualize. I think that's obviously a really huge part of it. Stephen Kemis, who's an Australian practice theorist, sociologist and practice theorist, he calls that mixing in. So taking a practice into a new context and introducing it and making it effective, he calls that mixing in, which I think is a lovely way of thinking about it. But it's the other part as well. It's about decontextualizing it. It's about taking it as observed in one context and understanding it as a thing on its own. How is it effective as a thing on its own? What do you do? What skills do you need? Blah, blah, blah. And then removing it out of that context in such a way it can be described and put into another context. I think that's super interesting. Super interesting part of practice theory. And I think it's the thing that if you look at how something like, I don't know, TDD, test-driven development, how that practice has spread or hasn't spread. It's been decontextualized, but where, you know, it's been written down how it's done, but where I think people really struggle is in the mixing it in, is in the contextualizing of it. I think that's a really interesting. I've got lovely imagery used for this with maturity maps. I quite like that kind of just tries to depict that, how things come out, how they're held in a space, whether it's in a book or in a head, and then mixed back into a new environment.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I went off on one there. I think you said that contextualized word again, and it sort of Pavlov's dog triggered me there. The story we're kind of heading down, I think it's one of my favourite change stories, is the joint venture, the Toyota-GM joint venture. And one of the things that GM tried to do in order to replicate it in a different environment was there was two things. One, they were from NUMMI, and they were called NUMMI Ninjas. They were people who came from NUMMI, and they were like agile coaches that went across all of these different GM plants to Toyota to give them the Toyota way. And that was effective at some agile transformation I've seen. Many agile, not effective. And the other thing they did was they said, go and take pictures of the whole plant and then recreate the plant somewhere else. So materially recreate it, but again, not understanding the practice that was involved. Crucially, not only the practice involved there, but also the interdependent practice that exists around about it from supply chains and things like that. But yeah, I think understanding the context and where to be effective in a context is crucial.
That's it for this episode. This episode of the Resilience Podcast was brought to you by Pronovix and Contextualize. You can learn more about our companies at pronovix.com and maturitymapping.com. Thank you for listening, and until next week, be sure to mind the context.